Today's guest, Shark Tank star investor and inspiring speaker, Barbara Corcoran. You're listening to the Eagles Talent Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Eagles Talent Speakers Bureau, for speakers who inspire, educate, and entertain. You can find us online at eaglestalent.com. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Eagles Talent Podcast. I'm your host, Sheldon Senek. Remember, you can listen to our podcast on our website or on the go at iTunes. Simply type Eagles Talent in the iTunes search. If you're interested in bringing any one of the speakers we have as guests on our podcast, you can do so by visiting us online at eaglestalent.com. Do you know how to take $1,000 and grow it into a million? Barbara Corcoran does. She's an inspiring woman who grew her company to success and is now one of the shark investors on the hit TV show Shark Tank. I recently had an opportunity to talk with Barbara about her TV show, her book Shark Tales, and about being an entrepreneur. As you'll hear, she's fun, personable, and knows business. Barbara Corcoran, welcome to the Eagles Talent Podcast. So honored that you could join us today.
Nice to be here, Sheldon. I've been a fan for a while.
Well, you know, first, I'm a huge fan of Shark Tank and even a huger fan of yours. So this is just wonderful to have you here.
Well, I don't care if you like me, but make sure you tune into Shark Tanks, which is Friday night at 8 o'clock. And then I don't care if you like me as long as you love the show.
Well, yeah, Barbara, you grew up in Edgewater, New Jersey. And if I'm correct, in a two-bedroom house, you had five sisters and four brothers. With such a large household, how did that prepare you for becoming an entrepreneur?
Can I tell you truthfully, I think it's an ideal environment to be raised in, to be an entrepreneur. Because when you have a really crowded household like that, you have to learn to compete to be heard by your parents. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't have like extra sets of parents around. We still had the same old two parents all the time. So if you have 10 kids, we were always competing for attention. So in a real way, a crowded household is just like growing up in your own town or your own business club. I mean, you really have to separate yourself from the pack, so to speak, just to feel like you got enough recognition.
You often talk about how your mother was such a powerful role model and motivator. Can you share how she helped inspire you?
Yeah, she had a great routine, and she didn't just inspire me, but she inspired each of her 10 children who all grew up very successful in their own rights. What my mother did is she didn't have a lot of time, so I believe, although she swears this wasn't her motivation when I talked with her, right. But I believe she just created an efficiency system in her household, and it went like this. She'd bring each child home from the hospital, show us who our new sibling, he or her, were. She'd unwrap them and tell us what that child's gift was. So for my gay brother T, she would announce that he would be a great ballet dancer, uh-huh. And he was. He became a ballet dancer. And why? Because she made him dance. She made him entertain us by, you know, dancing around, whatever. Maybe he was going to do it anyway, but you know what? I think she created him. Mm-hmm. For my brother Eddie, who was hell on wheels to be raised, he was hyperactive, couldn't control him, always in trouble. Mm-hmm. She labeled him a born leader. She said, "You're a born leader, Eddie. You're a born leader." And she kept underlining that. And the minute he was acting out, she'd say, "Every kid in the neighborhood's watching you, Eddie. You're a born leader. Show them what you got." And, you know, it was efficient for her to straighten out the siblings quickly like that, but spend most of her time underlining with her kids what she thought their one gift was. For me, she labeled me a great imagination. She'd say, "You have a great imagination. You have a great imagination." And what did I have to do in the family? We all had our roles. I had to entertain seven other kids. I had to put on the rock stores in the backyard. What's a rock store, I'd say? She'd say, "You'll figure it out. You have a great imagination." You know? So my mother used us and abused us for the better, honestly, because she was constantly underlining the little things she had time to do, which is to tell us what we were doing well and to insist that we demonstrate again and again. So we kind of grew up all all believing whatever that imprint she put on us. And you know what? It's not a bad formula for running a business, and tremendously helpful to me when I was building my business, as we all do, run out of time constantly.
Well, you know, and that's a great segue. Three things: technology, talent, and marketing. How important were those three elements to the success of your real estate company?
Honestly, not so much any of them. Those are my only choices you're giving me?
Well, what do you have?
Okay, I would say persistence, you know, or stick-to-itiveness, or pig-headedness, or the ability to take a hit and get back up, handling rejection. They would be way up on my list before the technology, the talent, or the marketing. I happen to be a very good marketer. That's my sweet spot. But you want to know, I wasn't good at technology. I wasn't good at necessarily ferreting out the most talented people in the world. But I could hire people like that. You can always hire those talents. I think what you can never hire out is persistence and coming back again and again for a swing at the ball. And if the leader of the business doesn't have that ability to do that, the rest of the team doesn't follow them up the mountain, you know? So I would say that your menu you gave me are nice, but not key to growing a business. I think sheer persistence is what brings you through the finish line every time.
Whether personally or professionally, and I think this with entrepreneurs, you know, we're so afraid of failure. Can you tell us how you see failure as a positive thing?
Well, I don't think it ever feels positive, failure, okay? I've never had a failure that I liked one bit, and I've never enjoyed the prospect of failing and all the stress that comes along with that as you're thinking you're going to fall on your head in whatever you're attempting to do.
Sure.
But I do believe that, well, for me, I don't know if it's true of everyone, but I bet a lot of people it's true for me, all of my best ideas came on the heels of failure when I was trying to cover them up so that publicly, meaning publicly my staff or the person to the right of me or left of me or the general public, wouldn't be on to the fact that I had really made a misjudgment or pissed away a lot of money or, you know, did these things that I that really demonstrate my inability versus ability on something. But I found that I was very, very good at making a failure or a flop, I would probably use a better word, a real flop, look pretty good because I'm a good cover-up, because I don't have enough substance or self-confidence in myself to admit a failure.
Right.
But you want to know, it kept me in great stead because, for example, I discovered, as an example, and there's many, many, but it just popped in my head, I discovered the internet as a result of a terrible business idea of putting all my homes, my apartments for sale on videotape. Long before the internet came about, and as luck would have it, the internet got born the following year, and by happenstance, I just discovered it when I was about to announce to everybody that my Homes on Tape venture that cost me $77,000 of money I should have never spent was a dismal failure. But I was able to at least have the video to throw it online when I heard about the internet. And I had I had two customers come in online within 1 week, so I was on selling
something,
say, online probably, God, almost 4 years before the industry was onto the best thing that was ever going to happen in real estate. So I think I'm really good at covering my tracks when I'm flopping. But that takes energy. And what? You can usually find some angle in it if you really just persist, you know, through that next little stage.
Well, I'd like to say congratulations on the second season of the hit television show Shark Tank. How did this opportunity come about?
I got a very lucky phone call. Not that it was just luck, because I at least was on the radar screen because I was doing TV work, but I got a very lucky phone call from Mark Burnett, who's that famous producer from, what's the name of that show?
Survivor.
Yeah, I don't know why I can never think of Survivor. The best title, best name, my God. But anyway, it wasn't from him personally, of course, because he's a god, but his assistant, who asked me if I'd like to be considered. Well, I sent tape after tape after tape. I knew instinctively it was a great fit for me because, honestly, I know a lot more about entrepreneurship than I know about real estate. You know, you have to know real estate to sell real estate. You have to know about entrepreneurship definitely to build a business. And so, so I was very eager to take that spot, sign the contract on it, sent the contract back, and then just days before I was going to fly out to LA, and I was even having dreams of the Hollywood sign up on that hill with me standing in front. I was like, 11 all over again.
Right.
I couldn't wait. I bought new outfits. I bought extra outfits. I even bought special pens to sign autographs. I mean, the show wasn't even on yet, and I'm like living in this fairyland. But the thing is, I got a call like just 3 days before I was supposed to leave, right after I signed the contract, saying they had changed their mind.
Oh, no.
That was, I couldn't believe it, because I knew I was going to be on that show. I just knew it from the get-go, you know? I uh-huh. couldn't shake that faith. And I thought, wow, how am I losing my instinct at this point in the game?
Uh-huh.
And so I was so angry over that rejection that I sat down with the two other people sitting around me at the office and banged out an email within minutes, a ferocious email.
Mm-hmm.
Not an insulting email, but a heartfelt, ferocious email. My opening line was, I consider your rejection a lucky charm. Because every one of the great successes I've had have followed in the heels of rejection, which I meant. And then I went bang, diddy, bang, diddy, bang, diddy, bang, and cited five or six things that had been a no thank you that turned into a whopper of a success for me. And you know what? I ended it by saying, and I plan on being on that plane on Tuesday morning. And you want to know? I got invited out to compete for the spot, because that's what I recommended. He had replaced me with a blonde bombshell that was a lot better looking than me.
Uh-huh.
But I at least suggested that he have us both come out and compete for the single female shark spot.
Uh-huh.
And you want to know? He did exactly that. Thank God I won that competition.
You know, it's interesting. When I watch a show, it really has a sibling rivalry atmosphere. Is that how it is from your perspective?
No, it's a killer rivalry. My siblings knew how to play fair. No. This is not about siblings. This is about enemy camp number 101.
So what have you learned as an investor from the first season to the second season?
Oh, so many things, I have to tell you. Number one, I have learned that in every season, I'm going to buy a clunker.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Who isn't going to be, once you start the due diligence, anything like what they're positioning themselves at on the show. People who say they have a patent, haven't even applied for a patent. People who say, who are waving these huge purchase money orders that they have, and all they need is your money to keep up with the demand, who have no purchase money orders. No, I don't mean to say purchase money. It's called what? POs, purchase orders.
Right.
See, I even learned what a PO was. I have to tell you, for half of the first season, guys, those sharks talking about, you have any POs? I didn't even know what the heck they were talking about. Now I can say, hey, you have any POs?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think how difficult it must be making a decision in a matter of minutes, really, or less, to invest, you know, thousands of dollars when you don't have all the accurate information.
Well, there's a couple of things you don't know as a viewer at home. Mm-hmm. One, each of those pitches are over an hour long.
Oh, really?
You're seeing 5 minutes because it's edited, of course. They have to edit. They have to get three or four pitches in a show.
Mm-hmm.
But we're seeing each one an hour long. We also have a lot of practice. We're seeing five pitches on average, or six pitches, for every one that eventually airs. They're picking the best and leaving the rest, you know? It's difficult to conclude very quickly on any account because you have no proof of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's something else that happens on Shark Tank that the viewer at home is not aware of, and that is when they walk that poor entrepreneur into the tank, they have instructed them not to speak until they're spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
And every entrepreneur standing there is ready to pitch. They've practiced it 100 times. They're dying to get going. And you know what the producer is whispering in our ears? Don't talk to them. Don't talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And we let them sit there for at least 5 minutes while they begin to sweat. I mean, they come in often making great eye contact with the sharks. It depends on the individual. Sometimes within 30 seconds. Some people, sometimes 4 minutes longer. What happens is they start to fall apart. And you want to know something? I can't express to you how meaningful that is for me, because what I'm watching is I'm watching the future of an entrepreneur under pressure. And the last guy I want to jump into bed with, guy or gal, is someone who's going to crumble under pressure, because, you know, in the end, that's often the dividing line between the people that get through and those that don't. You know? So that's a great heads up before they even speak. Usually I definitely don't know if I'm in before they speak, but I definitely know when I'm out.
Well, this year, Shark Tank, it seems like you added an extra element, the guest investors, people such as Mark Cuban and Jeff Foxworthy. How do their personalities change the dynamic of the show?
It's amazing what a difference who your guest shark or your regular shark, Kevin Harrington, makes to that show.
Mm-hmm.
He would swear that only one chair out of five couldn't influence it, but it's a tremendous influence. When Jeff Foxworthy was our guest shark, it took the tempo down in the show. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but he's old homeboy kind of, oh, now get you going. Let me tell you what I think. You know, that's his routine. His routine was like a more of a mountain routine of my routine. I mean, mm-hmm. It was dissettling for me because I'm usually the nice shark that says, I understand where you're going, blah, 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 you know. But he was doing my routine, but better. That really threw me off my game, I have to tell you. The businesses mm-hmm. I liked, he liked. Usually the guys don't like the businesses I like, okay? Mm. So that was a problem. I had a competitor there. Now, Mark Cuban's another whole story. Right. That guy's an animal. Yeah. And you know why he's an animal? Not that he has any more ego or drive than anybody else on that show, but he's got more bucks. Mm-hmm. That guy spends $1 million as though it's meaningless. And you know what? The minute he stepped on the show, the amount of money that was being spent by the other guys in the big competition as to who was the biggest man on campus went to the moon and back. Everybody started throwing money on the table. They didn't want to be outshone by the billionaire on the set. So, yes, it really sways what happens on that Shark Tank set big time because it greatly influences the personalities and where your competition comes from.
You know, you're very passionate about your work, your investments, and, of course, your most recent book, Shark Tales. Is it fair to say you hope to inspire readers to pursue their own passions?
Well, let me tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. If it did anything to get people off their butt and do what they've been dreaming and talking about, secretly or publicly, then I feel like I've done a great job in shoving them off the fence. You know why? I don't even care if people succeed or not as an entrepreneur. What I think the saddest thing in the world is for someone to have a dream and not to try to do it. Because you know what? I meet a lot of people in my line of work who have had tremendous successes and tremendous failures, and mm-hmm. some people who have only had one giant failure in attempting to do what their dream was. Mm-hmm. And you want to know, I've never heard them express regret. They might regret having listened to someone or this or that, but they wouldn't relive the chapter any other way. But you know who I hear regret from all the time are older people who always had this thing they really wanted to do and never tried to do it. Regret is a horrific thing to live with. It like takes your soul away from you little by little. And so I'm all for trying what you're dreaming about, whether you win or you lose, at least God, you've gotten out there and you've done it, you know? So it's about self-pride, I think, more than anything else. And what's more satisfying in life than self-pride? It's not about what you accomplished, really, because that gets empty once you've gotten some things done and bought mm-hmm. the car you wanted and stuff. It's really about self-pride of how you feel about yourself. That's where all the joy comes from, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just happy. That's my goal, that if somebody is thinking about, man, just get out there and give it a shot, you know? What's the worst that could happen? It's not like you're going to die. It's not like you've decided to jump off mountains as an entrepreneur. You're not going to die. So I just like to see people get out and do what they really want to do. Mm,
so well said. When you look back on your success, is there a single best decision you think you've made, or maybe a few best decisions that you've made?
The best decision clearly I made mm-hmm. was to start a business when I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
If I had known at even 25, now I started when I was almost 23, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If I had known even at 25, if I had worked in the New York doggy dog world for 2 years and then started my business, I'm not sure I would have been stupid enough to jump and do it. You know what I mean? Mm. I'm so thankful that I was stupid enough to start my business young, because I meet so many people that have that kind of raw energy and naive belief when they're young,
mm-hmm.
and then they get the lesson in life on how tough it really is out here.
Mm.
And then they give up a little bit by little bit or start analyzing the worst thing in the world. If you want to be a procrastinator, then be a big left brain, a deductive reasoning type. You know, you could deduct anything as a bad idea.
Right.
But I think starting young for me was my luckiest break. My second lucky break was when I was working at that diner that night, and in walked Ramon Simone, and he gave me the $1,000 to start the business. A lucky break that night. You know what I mean? Would I have met somebody else to give me $1,000 to start a business? Who knows? Maybe I would have been lucky in another realm, but I doubt it. That was just, you know, just a stroke of luck, really. But then just doing it was not luck. That was plain dumb naivety.
Hmm. So what's the best advice you have ever received?
Oh, the best advice I ever got clearly was Ramon Simone's parting words when he told me I'd never succeed without him.
Hmm.
Now, you might not say that's the best advice because it's really an insult, but for my personality, he couldn't have done anything better than tell me that. Really. If he had said, Barbara, you know, you've been amazing in the 7 years we've been together, and really, you're actually good at what you're doing, and, you know, chances are really good you're going to be great at this. Do you want to know? I think I would have fallen asleep at the wheel right then and there. Like, oh, that took my incentive away. But to give me an insult, thank you very much. He gave me an insurance policy that would assure my success. I have no doubt, looking back at that, that was key and the single best advice I ever got. Mm.
And what's your advice, lastly? What's your advice to future entrepreneurs?
It's not, you might not say, you know, I'm thinking practical, like don't forget this or don't forget that. All that, you know, if you're determined to do something, you're going to find your way. You'll find the help you need. You'll find the money you need. You'll find the parting of the waters just when you need it, if you have the determination. So that either have that kind of determination or you don't. I don't believe people build determination. Mm-hmm. I think they're either willful enough to have it and insist on it or not. But I would say, in terms of getting over the humps, I think the most important thing is that you feel that you have the right to be there, that you have the right, no matter what your background is, no matter what people have told you, no matter what you think is your deficit or what you can't do, you have the right to step up and claim your slice of life for what you want. You have as much a right as any other guy on the block, the educated kid, the wealthy kid, the guy who's a natural this or a natural that. You have the right, just as much as the next guy, to claim what you want in life for yourself. And you want to know something? That kind of stuff is all about self-talk. Talk, you know, how you talk to yourself. Because we all have a boogeyman inside us, you know, whether it be our parents telling us, be careful, whether it be this guy telling us you're a loser or this kid not being picked for the team we have, whatever our illnesses that we come into the adult life with, mm-hmm. we all have our shit, right, that we carry on in. Mm-hmm. But the thing is I think you have to really combat whatever your inner voices are that are telling you can't do it, you shouldn't do it, you maybe don't really have the talent to do it. I think you really have to slay the biggest dragon of all, which is never on the outside, it's on the inside. It's telling yourself that you have the right to be there, no matter what those voices are telling you. And I think you can win that argument, because I still feel when I'm insecure and I'm still battling it. But you want to know something? You get in the habit of battling it, which is a pretty good friend to yourself. So I think that would be my advice. Long-winded, I'm afraid. Too long-winded, but that's what I think.
No, not at all. It's great advice. Barbara, it's just amazing. You know, what an inspiring person, speaker you are. And it's a joy every Friday when Shark Tank is on to watch you on there.
At 8 o'clock.
At 8 o'clock.
Forgive me. I'm a promoter.
That's what it's all about. So, but they really, you are...
You know that.
Yes, you know, you were such a joy. You really are. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. And it's truly been a pleasure having you as a guest.
My pleasure, Sheldon. And again, congratulations on that silly name you have, Sheldon. You should talk to your parents about it.
I will. Thank you so much again for listening. I've been your host, Sheldon Sinek, and this is the Eagles Talent Podcast.